KALW.
Facebook is not bound by the same rules as the government is in restricting speech.
Mark Zuckerberg invites civil rights groups to dinner to talk about hate content on Facebook.
Their mission is about connecting people all over the world, but connecting people shouldn't amount to people being targeted because of their religion or their race or their sexual orientation.
We'll hear what the groups were asking for and what Facebook is doing about it. Then we meet a San Francisco DJ who says for him, it's about more than spinning tunes.
Because everyone's heart beats differently. And my job is to tap into their heart and their spirit and see who they are.
And we'll hear a sound from somewhere around the bay with Audiograph.
I'm known in Oakland as the Apron Lady.
I'm Henat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Late last month, this video clip went viral.
So you won't take down lies or you will take down lies? I think it's just a pretty simple yes or no.
I believe that people should be able to see for themselves what politicians that they may or may not vote for
are
saying.
So you won't take them down?
It's video of New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez questioning Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg on the platform's policies regarding political ads.
One more question. In your ongoing dinner parties with far-right figures, some of who advanced the conspiracy theory that white supremacy is a hoax, did you discuss so-called social media bias against conservatives, and do you believe there is a bias?
Facebook has been highly criticized for what it allows on its platform, political ads, but also what civil rights groups are calling violence-inciting hate speech. Groups like Color of Change and Muslim Advocates have been calling on the platform to address that kind of content. And on November 4th, they were invited to have a private, off-the-record dinner with Mark Zuckerberg in his Palo Alto home. So what did they talk about and what was the outcome? Madiha Ahusain is special counsel for anti-Muslim bigotry at Muslim Advocates. She joined me in studio to explain how it went.
The invitation came after nearly 7 years of Muslim Advocates alongside our partners in the civil rights space advocating for change on the platform. One thing in particular that we did a couple of years ago was really push for Facebook to conduct a civil rights audit. And we made that ask alongside our partners, stating that really you need to take a close look at the impact of your policies and procedures and how these policies are being enforced, because there's very clearly a discrepancy between enforcement and what we're seeing on the platform and in the policies that you have. So that was an audit that they agreed to do last year, and that's currently ongoing. So we've been engaging with them in this process, and I think the invitation to speak directly with Mark Zuckerberg was, you know, an opportunity for us to really raise those concerns directly with him.
And so just for those not on Facebook a lot or not aware of the issues,
yeah, sure.
What is going on this platform that is of concern?
So I think there are a number of buckets in which we could sort of talk about these issues. One that has been really critical for, I think, American people generally is interference with elections. That has been a concern that was raised a couple of years ago after we saw what happened in the 2016 election cycle. There was breaking news that Facebook essentially was manipulated and used by people in Russia to interfere with elections. Now, that particular issue isn't the crux or the focus of the work that we've been doing and advocating on behalf of for our community, but we recognize that all of these issues are connected because it's important that Facebook take a close look at the way in which the platform can be used by people that are trying to target individuals. So when the Russia news broke out, we also learned that trolls or whoever they were in Russia, basically they used Facebook to organize division in our country. The way in which they did that, as one example, is we found out that they organized a protest outside of a mosque in Houston using essentially like a fake group profile. And then they simultaneously organized a counter protest right across the street. And so what that does is it shows you that you're pitting people in Houston, Texas, against one another. You have people that are against Muslims, and then you have people that are for Muslims, and they are coming and showing up and looking for where the organizers are, and nobody's ever heard of who these organizers are. This group is essentially fabricated and created by people in Russia, thousands and thousands of miles away. Now, the really crazy thing is that that's not the first time we've heard of mosque protests being organized on Facebook. There are well-known anti-Muslim hate groups that are active and thriving on Facebook. They are organizing demonstrations, many of them armed, outside of they're using the event pages tool that you can use on Facebook to create an event. You can make those events public. You can invite whoever you want. And not only are they organizing the events, but then the event page itself becomes a breeding ground for hate. So you have people that are sharing comments, posting horrible, phrases that are targeting Muslims, saying to commit violence against Muslims, calling for action against Muslims. And this is a reality in which Facebook is operating, where people are using the platform to actually incite violence against our community. Another example, which I think many people probably are aware of, is what happened in Christchurch. And that was another example of how Facebook was used by someone perpetrating violence against a community, and they broadcast it live stream for thousands and thousands and millions of people to see across the world. So there's always concern that people are going to get ideas from that type of violence. They're going to commit similar acts of violence, or they're going to use it as an opportunity to continue to target communities. So that's just some examples. Public officials are also taking to Facebook and even other social media platforms and, again, either inciting violence or spreading misinformation and lies. We've seen our Muslim public officials being targeted on Facebook, death threats against Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib and Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. So these are all examples of how the Facebook platform is being used to target our community.
And it is a tricky issue. I think part of what they're saying, what other platforms have said, is this idea of hate speech and defining kind of free speech and hate speech and what amounts to hate speech. It sounds like it's a complicated kind of thing to navigate. So what has Facebook said to you in terms of your demands or your asks of them?
Facebook is not bound by the same rules as the government is in restricting speech. Facebook has created a platform and owns multiple communication products. Not only is it Facebook as a platform, it's also Instagram, it's also WhatsApp. And they need to make decisions about what they believe is contributing to society in a meaningful way, because their mission is about connecting people all over the world. But connecting people shouldn't amount to people getting killed. It shouldn't amount to people being targeted because of their religion or their race or their sexual orientation.
And so I know you can't say what Zuckerberg said, but what was, like, did Muslim advocates come out feeling heard? What was the impression leaving?
Yeah, feeling heard is a great way to describe what we took away from that meeting. And it further reminded us of the need to continue to make sure that not only Mark Zuckerberg, but Sheryl Sandberg and other senior members of their team are fully aware of how the platform is continuing to be used to harm people.
What do you want to see immediately or very soon happen that will put you at ease somewhat that, yes, he took it seriously, he's working on this? What kinds of things?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we are still anticipating is the conclusion of the audit. And so that is expected to come early next year, as far as we've been told. And I think that the conclusion of the audit will be very telling as far as whether they're making any commitments and whether they have, you know, announce that they will be making changes. The civil rights audit is going to be a great piece that we can use in our advocacy because we want more information from that audit. But that has an end date to it. So what happens when the civil rights audit is over is we want a permanent civil rights infrastructure within the company where there's experts who can say, you need to continue to examine the way in which your policies are affecting communities and how civil rights are being infringed upon because of what's happening on your platform. So that, I think, would be a very big step, is if we can see that they are committed and serious about maintaining some sort of structure internally that will continue to provide oversight and accountability for the company.
Madiha Ahusain is special counsel for anti-Muslim bigotry at Muslim Advocates. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. DJ Lamont didn't fall in love with San Francisco when he first visited the city, but his instincts told him to move here. For nearly 20 years, he's been leading DJ classes in the Mission at his business, Fingersnaps Media Arts. And when he's not teaching spinning skills, DJ Lamont is getting the party started at events around the Bay Area. He spoke to KALW's Janae Darden about his path to music.
How long have you been DJing?
I've been DJing for 41 years.
41 years. Mm-hmm. Wow.
In many regards, I'm a chameleon when it comes to music, because you may hear me on Monday and I have this sound. You hear me on Tuesday, I have this sound. You listen to my radio show, I have this sound, because I'm a musicologist. I love music. So I play all these different genres based on the audience and the community that I'm playing for. My mother was a huge music fan. My mother obviously grew up in the 60s and Motown and the whole experience of the musical revolution of the 60s inspired her. And she said that she used to just run to the record store and buy stacks and stacks of 45s at that time. So growing up in the early 70s, I remember her playing these records. And wherever we went, in the car, in the kitchen, in the living room, and specifically on the weekends when family would just drop in and music would be playing all day, cleaning the house, frying chicken, frying fish, making a big pot of collard greens, just home. And family would just trickle throughout the day, and music was the soundtrack. From Al Green to Crystal Gayle to Dolly Parton to the Rolling Stones, it was just blaring all the time. And me being who I was at the time, I was a sponge and I just listened. And so as I grew older, I just somewhat regurgitated that music that I heard.
And so that sparked your interest in DJing.
Well, that's where the interest began. For many years, I would sleep with the radio on, and I would wake up in the middle of the night, and I would have chills because I would hear this new song, and it just captivated me. And I couldn't wait to go to school the next day and tell my friends about the song that I heard on the radio at 3 o'clock in the morning. So music was a way of expressing myself. Back in it was January of 1995, I was dating this man who went to rehab in Los Angeles. And the plan was that I would fly out at the conclusion of his program and fly to LA. We would drive up the coast and come to San Francisco. At the time, my mother was terminally ill with cancer. And it was the 1st of January of 1995, and I wasn't gonna go. And I remember my mother was in the hospital, and I says, well, I'm staying. And she says, why? I says, well, you're under the condition you're in. I don't want to go. And she found enough strength to lift her head up off the pillow and say, well, you're going. She says, I'll be here when you get back. Don't worry. And so I flew out to California, went to LA. That was my first time. We drove up the coast. We arrived in San Francisco. And I didn't like it. San Francisco, because it wasn't the California that us East Coast people.
Right. It wasn't Baywatch.
It wasn't warm.
Right.
Not even Baywatch. It wasn't warm. I mean, I saw palm trees. I saw the beach.
Yeah.
But I had on a leather jacket. And I just remember every street being flooded. And I know this is an exaggeration, but I just remember every street being flooded. And it was cold and windy and dark. And I just said, what the heck is this? This is not the California that I've seen on TV. However, when I was driving home that night, when we were driving to the airport that night, the city cleared up. The weather cleared up. The sky cleared up. And as we were driving on 101, I'm looking at the city, looking out the window, and I says, wow, this is incredible. And when I went home, my mother was receiving chemotherapy at that time, and I plopped down next to her, held her hand, and she says, how was California? And I said, I didn't like it. But I said, I think I'm going to move there someday. And that was like one of the last things that I shared with my mother, because she passed a few weeks later. About a year later, when I was somewhat recovering and just learning to live without her, I went swimming at the YMCA, as I always did, and I jumped in the pool. And the moment I jumped in, I had this vision. And the vision said, quit your job, sell your house, sell your car, and move to California. And the vision stopped. September of 1996, I packed up 75 boxes of records, 2 turntables, some clothes, some furnishing, went into U-Haul, and drove cross country. One of the first events that I did was hosted by this young lady named Boa. It was a lesbian party, and it was called Voyeur. And it was in this basement of this nightclub that's off of 8th Street. And it was an erotic event. And my turntables were set up right next to the stage, and the stage was maybe 4x4. And these women got on stage and were doing this erotic performance. And I would turn to my right, and all these eyes were looking at the stage. But in the meantime, I'm perceiving them looking at me because I'm right on stage too. And like, oh my God, all these women are looking at me while these women are doing this you know, artistic erotic.
They weren't looking at you.
Yeah, of course. But that was my first event in San Francisco. That was my first paid gig.
That's a very San Francisco story, too.
I was the only man in the place, so it was really fun. Well, yes, but I came prepared to play.
You probably see, I mean, because DJing at parties, you see everything.
Well, that's the thing. A DJ is a social worker in many regards, because the idea is that you are working the behavior of all these different groups, and the idea is to somewhat be yourself in all these different micro communities that one works in. And so I think it's beautiful, because as an artist, you do have this opportunity of being invited to these micro groups, these micro communities that are here or beyond, and to be part of that experience and try to understand them with the music that you play, and to connect with them with the music that you select. So that was part of the soul searching of saying, okay, how can I be myself? What gifts do I have to offer someone that they need? And I realized DJing, learned to DJ, and I realized it meant something to someone else that wants to learn this, but they need guidance. Just like we all need guidance for something. And I created it for myself to offer something to myself. And it goes back to how I feel about not always feeling connected to people and my own sense of internal isolation that I feel from time to time. Mm-hmm. I says, but with this service, I can connect with someone. Every person is different. My classes are primarily one-on-one, and that's the emphasis on connecting with people again, because everyone's heart beats differently. And my job, my goal as a teacher, as a facilitator, is to tap into their heart and their spirit and see who they are and why they're relating to this music the way that they're relating to it.
What do you love most about what you do?
The freedom to be myself, which has taken great effort. Every day I have to put me together, spiritually, physically, mentally, with all of the psychological things that impress upon me, from political to social to my own families, my own personal interactions, and making sense of that, which still makes sense of myself. Just DJing is an opportunity for people to not just be on a stage and play music, but it's an opportunity for them to create something special for themselves and a way of connecting with people the way that you feel that you need to.
That was KLW's Janae Darden speaking with DJ Lamont. He'll be spinning tonight at 6 p.m. at Ruth's Table in San Francisco. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Next up, our audiograph series that maps the sounds of the Bay Area. This one is a real neighborhood favorite.
Do you want change for your five?
I'm known in Oakland as Sherry Jean, the waitress machine, and also known as the apron lady.
Let's meet the apron lady with reporter Bonnie Chan in this story from our archives.
It's a Saturday morning at Mama's Royal Cafe in Oakland, and Cooper is in the middle of her shift. She's waitressed here for 36 years.
I am a career waitress, and when I get up to go in the morning, it's showtime to me. It's showtime.
Today, Cooper's wearing a necklace with charms that spell out Oakland, California, and her waitress earrings. Dangly earrings with a miniature fork, spoon, spatula, and creamer. She has a pink flower in her hair that matches her shirt, and also, she says, her underwear.
No one knows that I got a pink bra, pink Gandhi, pink bows, and no, it's a liberty. It's a liberty.
The cafe, as it always is on weekends, is packed. But Cooper says she has so much waitressing experience, she can hear a piece of silverware fall on the floor even when every table is seated. And without looking, she can tell which table it dropped from.
I could tell if it's fork, knife, or spoon that hit the floor. Four needs a fork, and one needs that, and seven needs that.
Mama's has been serving up the same recipes for decades, and serving some of the same customers for that long, too.
And we love their breakfast.
June and Greg, whom I find waiting outside for their names to be called, are longtime patrons. They live near Lake Merritt and have made a ritual of walking to Mama's for breakfast on weekends.
We always get the eggs and the hash browns and the wonderful toast and the delicious strawberry jam, the best I've ever eaten. And their eggs are always perfect. Greg, what do you want to say?
I want to say you're right, darling.
Customers love the food, and they love the ambiance. Sherry Jean Cooper's vintage handmade aprons decorate one of the walls of Mama's. She changes them out seasonally. A tiny one that Cooper crocheted has her granddaughter's name on it, Dahlia. On another wall are dozens of napkins displayed under plexiglass. They're winning entries from past napkin art contests, where customers submit their napkin doodles. Though doodles might not be the right word. One of the napkins depicts a pen and ink wolf so lifelike it looks like it's keeping an eye out for customers' bacon.
Everyone at the restaurant who worked there always said, this is a movie. This is totally a movie.
That's napkin doodler and professional artist Mimi Pond in a KCRW interview talking about her experience working at Mama's. She wrote a graphic novel called Over Easy, based on her time working there in the late 1970s. Here she is reading a selection about when she was first hired.
Wait! I've never washed dishes before, but I'm very responsible. I'm a hard worker. You won't be sorry. Frank turns and looks at me like I'm nuts. Looks at Laszlo, shakes his head, and goes through the double doors. I stare at the doors flapping back and forth. I'm in. I'm no longer an art student. I am a dishwasher in a coffee shop. Nothing could sound better to me.
I just feel that people like to come here, feel that it is part of the community.
That's George Marino, who's been the owner of Mama's for the past 42 years.
Now I have people coming in with their young children, who used to come in as young children with their parents.
Before Marino took over, the space was a Chinese restaurant called Royal Cafe. And the hints of that old restaurant are still there, in the form of a decorative pagoda on the wall behind the cash register.
There wasn't much money to upgrade the decor at that time. I mean, we pretty much left everything the way it was, and it still is the way it is.
Except for the aprons and napkin art, of course. And some other things are about to change. In July, Marino announced he is selling Mama's so that he can spend more time with his wife. He's 68 years old, and he's been running Mama's for 42 years. He says customers have, for the most part, been really supportive, though also a little panicky.
People are always coming in and want to know when we're going to close, and we're not closing. I think there's a rumor going around that we're closing, but that's not happening. We're just trying to sell the restaurant. I'm trying to sell the restaurant and have it continue on.
Marino isn't selling the building itself, which he'll continue to own. He's selling the business. And he's in no rush, so he's looking for a buyer who will work to keep the spirit of Mama's alive.
I'm obviously going to really miss coming here every day. That's going to be a transition that's probably be... I've kind of made my peace with that, but I think it's going to be a little difficult, and I hope that this business goes on.
When Marino retires, it sounds like Sherry Jean Cooper will too.
What are your plans? Are you going to retire?
I assume I friggin' will, but I'm going down with the ship. That stuff may take a year or so, but I go with the ship, and I'm bloody well old enough to retire.
Hopefully, at least her aprons will stay. In Oakland, I'm Bonnie Chan for Cross Currents.
Thanks, Bonnie. You can find more Audiograph sounds from around the Bay Area at KALW.org, and make sure while you're there to subscribe to the Cross Currents newsletter. Today's Cross Currents team includes Julia Linas Goodman, Kristen McCandless, True Gwynn, Marissa Ortega Welch, and Victor Tenz. Our engineers are James Rollins, Tarek Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shireen Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.